Thanks all for coming. Nice sunny afternoon in New York City. So what I'm going to do today is we've just published a report on this research, which is available at a website. And I'm going to, this is the website here, www.freelunch.me, not .com, .me. Just remember, I often mistake it myself for .com. It's the report of where we are with the research. But first of all, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how I got into this project, working on Amazon.com, book reviewers and product reviewers in general. And then I'll run through some of the report, some of the main findings. And please interrupt me if you've got any questions, any stage. So I have here, I was showing this to Jake earlier, a book, Analog Days. This is a book I published on the history of the electronic synthesizer, the Moog synthesizer. This book came out in 2002 with Harvard University Press. And if you're an author, Amazon's an exciting place to go. One thing they have at Amazon, of course, is the sales ranking of your book. And all authors love to watch, you know, how you go up and down the sales ranking. And you may just sell a few copies, but you'll jump up the ranking. So it's exciting to look at. But they also put the reviews that you've got of the book on the website. And so there's my book. As I said, the hardback came out in 2002 at Harvard University, the paperback a couple of years later. And you get what they call editorial reviews pasted at the website. And there's one here from the Library Journal. And I just want you to remember this phrase, how it starts. It says, the sleek digital synthesizer of today is so easy to play and so ubiquitous, blah, 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 it goes on. And they put also reviews from notable people. There's a review here from Sir George Martin, the fifth Beatle, who actually owned his own Moog synthesizer and could play it along with George Harrison. Remember, the Beatles' most popular piece of music, Here Comes the Sun, uses the Moog synthesizer. But I'm not here to talk about the Moog synthesizer, but this is what I want to show you is how Amazon works. And there's a point to this, because we're going to get into how I got into the study. So you have also the customer reviews at Amazon. We're all familiar with these. And if you're publishing especially a non-fiction book on a topic like this, I found the reader reviews, the customer reviews, incredibly useful. They were very well done. I was excited about them. They were mainly positive. And I felt I was reaching the sort of community of people I wanted to reach. For instance, at the bottom here, this reviewer says, as a synth freak, I couldn't put this book down. That was the sort of people I wanted to appeal to. So I was quite excited about the customer reviews. Not everybody is, by the way. I have a novelist friend in Ithaca, and I think for a literary a novelist, some of these customer reviews can be very annoying. So he told me, I remember a quote he said, any prick with a computer can ruin my weekend. Basically, you know, posting a negative review of one of his novels. But anyway, so there's the customer reviews. But Amazon has this feature where you can go to other, if you bought one product, you can buy another product. And so one day I was browsing through other products on Amazon, and I found another book on synthesizers. And I started to look, just out of curiosity, at the customer reviews that this other person had got. This is an author called Ben Ketterwell for a book called Electronic Music Pioneers. And you'll see this customer review starts off, the sleek digital synthesizer of today is so easy to play and so ubiquitous, which is exactly the same words in that Library Journal review. Well, it turns out this review, rather than talking about the review for me, it's been doctored a little. It talked about the research of Trevor Pinch. Here it talks about this guy's research instead. Essentially, it's with a few word changes, it's basically a plagiarized review. So the word Ketterwell, you know, in mine it says Pinch and Trocker, there's two authors. Here it just says Ketterwell, Crocker. So it's been doctored. Turns out this person who did the review, Alex Treman, is what they call in the business a sock puppet, basically a fake email address. We don't know who this person really is, whether they exist. It might be the editors, it might be the agents, it might be the authors. We don't know who it is who's posted this. There were about four of these that were copied from the customer reviews and the editorial reviews for my book, for this similar book. I found this really kind of annoying because I really love these customer reviews, and here were my great customer reviews being copied. We discovered these back in 2003. I told my publisher, Harvard, they contacted Amazon, but at that point, Amazon didn't take them down. And they've remained ever since. I did these screenshots just two or three days ago. So these still remain there, these plagiarized reviews. So this got me interested in this whole business of customer reviewing at Amazon. And I worked with a grad student and who was in computer science. And we wrote, he mainly did the technical work here, an algorithm for looking for plagiarism more systematically amongst the customer reviews. By the way, that's the book that Electronic Music Pioneers, that the reviews were copied to. So we looked, we did a study, we published this back in 2006, and at that website I gave you at the beginning, there's a link to this particular study. We examined 50,000 items, mainly books and CDs reviews, and we found 1% of the text was copied, basically. Now, it's not all straightforward plagiarism. Some of it's copying and pasting, saying, you may want to buy this product somewhere else, and that shows up as copied text. A much larger study of 4 million book reviews by some colleagues of mine at Cornell in computer science found this figure as well, 1% copied. In the most recent study I'm going to talk about today of Amazon top reviewers, 35% of them report that their reviews have been copied. So it's a much larger number. And I suspect this is because these are the top reviewers, that people have more incentive to copy their text, so they experience this more. Also, almost certainly, these people get this text deleted from the website, so it doesn't necessarily show up at the website, but this is their reporting on their experience. So we did this study, we found plagiarism. At the same time, by the way, there have been stories in the media. There was a glitch on the Amazon Canada website in 2004 where you could see the real names of the people who posted the reviews. And this was reported in the New York Times in an article that basically authors were reviewing their own work and panning that of rivals. And this is a well-known feature. Occasionally these glitches happen. Occasionally people have been outed for doing this. Okay, so that's another form of review abuse. Okay. So for this study, which I did with Philip Kessler, we thought what we'd do is we'd start to trace a little bit of the history of Amazon to try and understand, first of all, where these customer reviews are coming from. I mean, it's kind of interesting, if you read the history, there's a book by Spector, there's one by Marcus called Amazonia. Marcus was a literary editor who was hired by Amazon in the early days. It turns out that the early vision of Amazon as a company was as a kind of literary endeavor. It's almost like a literary magazine. And Jeff Bezos hired lots and lots of literary editors to work for Amazon, including this guy, Marcus. And these editors were originally hired to write lots of the reviews. So these reviews were going to be written by these literary editors that Amazon hired. So this guy, James Marcus, was hired as a literary editor in 1996. And he was interviewed in Starbucks, where else, in Seattle. And the question he was asked was, how fast could you review 100 books? And this was rather off-putting. But he realized this is what he'd be doing at Amazon. And he said it was less like a literary venture and more like a pie-eating contest. Amazon, back in the early days, just to stress again the literary pretensions, it would do things like the greatest story ever told. I don't know if anyone here remembers that, which was a kind of a venture in open source writing a novel where John Updike wrote the opening paragraph, and then readers would submit another paragraph, and there'd be a competition, then another paragraph, and it went on, for something like 44 weeks, and then finally John Updike ended the whole thing up. Marcus has an amusing description of this in his book. He says, it's rather like Mozart appearing on American Idol, John Updike being involved in this endeavor. It didn't win any great literary plaudits, but back then they were trying to do literary things. Okay. But slowly over time, what happened is these literary editors were fired or moved on. The term customer review was introduced by Amazon for the first time in 1996 by a guy called Glenn Fleischman, who worked as the catalog editor at Amazon. And Amazon basically discovered the power of these customer reviews. It encouraged people. It initially had prizes for customer reviews. Everyone would be writing them at Amazon, including the warehouse staff. But slowly over time, they used the power of the web, and customers themselves started to write more and more of these reviews. So by the year 2000, most of these literary editors, including Marcus, had left or moved on, and more of the content of the website is being provided by the customers. And this is kind of the launching point for our study, because this guy, Philip Kessler, an internet entrepreneur out in Silicon Valley, He saw my earlier study of plagiarism, and he sent me an email. He asked me this question. He said, how come all these people are working for free? Basically, Amazon used to have to pay all these people, but now that basically they can get all this content for free, how come people are doing it? And this is the website's called Free Lunch, because the interesting topic is Amazon is getting a huge free lunch from the morsels of all these customer reviews that people are doing. Research has shown customer reviews sell products, this has been shown, and we now know that customer reviews are ubiquitous all over the web. You can get professors, rate my professor, doctors, Travelocity, there's many, many sites, and there's these ones that try and corral the opinions together. eOpinions, for instance, tries to do this. So customer reviewing is a big deal now. But it seems that Amazon kind of stumbled into it, and it's been very important for them. And these reviewers, who are the reviewers, have never been studied before. So prompted by Kessler's question, the free lunch issue, we thought, well, how can we find out something about why these people do it? Let's do a survey of the top 1,000 reviewers at Amazon. The top 1,000, by the way, are a designation that Amazon itself has for its top reviewers. It's not our designation. You get a badge at the site. If you're a top 1,000 reviewer, if you're a top 500 reviewer, a top 50 reviewer, a top 10 reviewer, and the number one reviewer at Amazon. And these are badges, so it'll be a customer review. It'll have that badge on the review, giving that extra credibility. So the questions we were interested in, who are these people? What motivates them? How well, we call this a reputation economy, how well does it function over a period of time? These were the questions that we were motivating our study. And here's the free lunch. Our assumption was there are no free lunches. That was actually Philip's original assumption. And as I say, they provide the morsels for one of the biggest free lunches ever. So why do reviewers, in fact, work for Amazon for free was one of the things that was behind our research, that motivational question. Okay, so we did this survey. It's an online survey. It was administered in January 2009. What we did, we wanted to work completely independent of Amazon. So what we did was we got the names of the top 1,000 reviewers from the Amazon website, and then we started combing the internet for their email addresses, because we didn't want to go through Amazon. We found 404 of their email addresses, and this became our sample frame. So the survey, the people we approached were these 404. We ended up with 166 reviewers from the top 1,000 at Amazon.com. As I say, 1,000 is top 1,000 is Amazon's own designation. But this gets confusing, because just before our survey was administered, Amazon introduced a new way of ranking their reviewers. And so if you go to the website, you'll see there's two. Every reviewer has now two ranks. You can find your own ranking there. If you ever published a customer review at Amazon.com, you will have a ranking. And you'll have a ranking under what they call new reviewing and classic. The old system has been renamed Classic, which is a move across familiar from Coca-Cola's repackaging, Classic Coke. By the way, the sample rate, I think, is formally 43%. It's in the report. It's actually quite a high rate. No, sorry, it's 35% for an online survey. This is allowing for invalid email addresses. Some of those email addresses we got off the web didn't actually work, so this is allowing for returned emails. This is quite a good. People who do online surveys tell me this is quite a good rate. And we were very lucky here that Amazon, just as we were doing the survey, had introduced this new ranking system, because the reviewers didn't like this new ranking system, because some of them lost their ranking position because of it. There was a lot of controversy and consternation amongst the reviewing community. So we hit them at a very good time, I think.
So which did you?
Oh, sorry.
You came after the change. So were you classic or new?
We were classic. So ours was we'd done all the work compiling the email addresses when there was only one ranking system. So we'd done all that hard work, you know, finding these addresses, combing the internet, and we were all ready to go. And then literally about a week before we were going to go, they administered the survey. They introduced this new one. So we stayed with the classic. It turns out, by the way, one of the questions we asked everybody in the survey is, what's your classic rank and what's your new rank? The top 1,000, the 166 we looked at, 21 dropped out of the top 1,000 under new ranking. So there's a considerable overlap, in other words, between the two ranking systems.
Did Amazon know you were doing this?
No, they didn't. They didn't. But once we'd administered the survey, it became a topic on the discussion boards at Amazon.
Did you drop them after they dropped off? Did you say, well, then you can't participate?
To which ones?
To the ones, those 21.
No, because we didn't. We only got information after they participated. We got that information. We asked them, so that was a part of the survey return.
But you didn't drop them out of your calculation.
No. We make it clear this is based on the old ranking, the 1,000, and we offer comments on what might be and say that there needs to be more research done on this new ranking. But ours is based on the classic. But as I said, there's a huge amount of overlap as well. So I think the findings are valid also for the new as well. Just on the, so it became a topic on the, Amazon has lots of discussion boards. Our survey became a topic. There's a link to that discussion in the report, which you can download. And people who weren't included started to pressurize us on the discussion board. They said, why aren't I in this survey? So we decided to put a link for volunteers, and we got 5 more respondents who were top 1,000. And we decided to include those as well in the survey, those 5, because they were all top 1,000. So we included those. 5 extra people.
And when was that?
Sorry?
When was that?
The discussion, I think, was in early 2009, probably March 2009. The exact date is in the report. Yeah. And there's a link to the actual moment when the discussion board took up our survey. You can go and look and see what people thought about it.
Cool.
And, you know, it was, some people thought it was great. One or two said, oh, this isn't the best survey. Someone from India did one years ago. Have you checked that one out? Blah, blah, blah. So there's lots of interesting little comments about the whole thing. So here's some of the findings then. We're now launching into the findings from the survey. So this gender, we asked everyone their gender. This is hard to find out without actually asking people. If you look at the profiles, many people hide their gender. We also know that on the web, they often put fictitious genders into profiles as well. So I think this is a fairly accurate representation by actually asking, unless they actually, they're going to fill in this survey. It's going to take quite a lot of time. If they're lying about their gender on the survey, we can't ever show that. But I'm assuming that this is pretty accurate.
What's your what is it, the error, what do they call it?
Margin of error?
It's hard to put a formal mark. These are just descriptive statistics.
Right, but overall, is there a margin of error for the results?
No, it's not that sort of study, basically. So they have simple descriptive statistics. So basically,
that obviously would be, you know, there's no question of what's a man and what's a woman.
Yeah,
In other aspects.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. I say other than if they're lying, which is always a possibility, any survey. But you can't, that's like, we call that a systematic error. It's impossible to actually put that into a statistics because that's when people deliberately lie. 70%, 30%. Now, the interesting thing about this is that there was a study in the New Republic by Ruth Franklin just very, very recently of gender bias in magazine book reviewing and New York Times book reviewing and so on. And she raised this as an issue because she discovered exactly this same ratio, that 70% of the reviews in these prestigious literary outlets were done by men, 30% by women. And we're finding exactly the same ratio for online reviewing. One of the things interesting about this, you would think the normal gatekeeping mechanisms are not here because anybody can do these reviews. Okay, but this is the top 1,000. There's probably a selection mechanism going here. One of the respondents said, motivations was competition. It's a male competitive spirit. So the ones that reach the top 1,000, they may be more motivated. So that may be where the gender thing is kicking in. There's another factor here that Franklin also found out, that there was a gender bias in actually who does the writing. Most books that are published in America, a good proportion of them are produced by men as well. You can look at the Franklin original article in New Public for her exact statistics on that. And what we found out, that is going on here as well, because it turns out that 40% of our people in the sample are actually authors themselves. They're producing the same sort of material they're reviewing. They're writers, journalists, authors, and academics. We'll get to this in a moment. So, and also we looked at the gender in balance amongst the ones who were authors, and 70% of those authors were men as well. So you have the same factor going on here.
Using the word authors, you don't really mean writers.
Writers is better, yeah, writers, yeah. Yeah, writers, that's the more correct, thank you. Yeah, with the more general term. Okay, so here's some, so we gender occupation. So if you include, look here, 13%, this is the other, 13% here, educators, 14% writer, correct term. So those are the two biggest blocks up there at 27%. But also, a very significant number here, and we'll get to the age distribution, this group here, we found this surprising. There's 11% are retirees. And it turns out that reviewing for Amazon.com turns out to be a great retirement hobby. Okay. So the fact that these are, you know, people who are writing stuff and educators really isn't that surprising. But the retirees was a surprise to us because the image of the internet is more of a young person's thing. So there's the age profile there. So you see the median age band is in this 51 to 60 range here.
14% of writers or 40%?
40.
40 altogether, if we combine everybody. A question we asked in the survey was, do you produce the same sort of material as you review? Thinking that there may be people also who produce music who reviewed CDs. And we actually found that the exact figure I was saying for now is 39%. 39% of them produced the same material that they reviewed. And most of those people, and 99.9% of those were writers.
I'm surprised because professional writers who work for money will seldom want to do something like this. It's at least my feeling among the people that I know. And I just wonder when you say writers, it's a big, big category. And I think
I would be a writer under this category as well.
Could you go back a screen to that?
Sure.
So the 27% is educators?
No, these are the others. These are the others.
These are other
categories. We had two priests. They're four unemployed. So these are all the other categories that didn't fit into these general ones.
We got educators were 13%.
Yeah, 13% here are educators.
And then writer says 14 over there.
Yeah, 27%, yeah. We asked this, so these are the ones that are formally under this occupation, but we asked this question, do you produce the same material?
And that's 40%.
And that's for the 40%. And then we looked at them, and then...
Includes writers or debater?
Yeah, yeah. So we know that they're, one was a musician, okay. Okay, sorry, it's confusing.
I'm just wondering, have you compared with other surveys the kind of occupations that you find people who fill out surveys without being paid, what it is. I'm just wondering the retired, that would be my natural inclination to think that they would be a much higher percentage.
Of Amazon reviews or people who bother to fill out surveys?
Yeah.
So in other words, you think it's a response bias that they're more likely to...
I'm just wondering. It raises a question.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's a valid question to think about.
Now, since I'm color weak, what is retired? Okay.
Oh, where is retired? Sorry.
Top there.
Purple. So this is the retired here. 11%. Yeah. When I've told people about this finding, shared it with people, they say they're not surprised. They say, "Oh yeah, you know, we've got parents who do this, you know, and." That this is a retirement hobby, so...
I can see one.
Yeah. And then we've also got the data on the median age as well, which is older than we expected. Okay, so that's the other correlation on this, the median age data. It shows they're middle-aged. Okay, so this is the first time this sort of survey's been done for these product reviewers, so we have no other surveys of product reviewers that we can compare with here. So we're kind of into, this is the first one, steps into the dark. Age profile, we've looked at. Highest educational level, no surprise, you know, these are highly qualified people. You see high school 10, so 90% of them have, you know, undergraduate degrees, masters. If you put together doctors, masters, undergraduate, you've got 90% there. So these are highly qualified people.
1/5 have doctorate degrees.
Yeah. Okay?
Yeah.
So here's the thing with the 40% review of the same items they produce. In fact, 40% are authors, including, I will change this
to writers.
That's the correct term. Writers, including academics, journalists, novelists, cookbook writers, etc. So a whole range of different sorts of writers here. But their writing is their kind of profession. So there's a crossover here between their daytime profession and reviewing for Amazon. And this shows up in also of other sorts of things, like there's one of the prolific reviewers we're going to get to is a dentist. And so he reviews dental products, including toothpaste. So people are looking for crossovers between their daytime jobs and this reviewing for Amazon. How long have they been reviewing? We have data on this. They've been reviewing between 3 and 13 years, average time spent reviewing 9 years. So these are very experienced reviewers overall. So we can't sort of say these are just newbies. These are very experienced reviewers. So we started to look in our sample at the most prolific reviewers. I didn't have a big enough chart here to show this on PowerPoint. In the report, we look at the 30 most prolific. Here, I'm just highlighting the 10 most prolific reviewers for 1 year. And they're producing a lot of reviews, okay? So this is just for 1 year of data. We could actually go to the website and count the number of reviews. This is not their own estimation. We know who they are. We can count their reviews from the website, how many they produce in a particular year. So we did this for all our respondents, and the top one was producing, this is 2008 to 2009, produced 862 reviews. 768, down like that. It follows a Powell law that most of the reviews are done by a small percentage. Okay, and this is generally known feature of reviewers found in other studies as well.
Powell law?
So Powell law, kind of so it tails off. The amount done goes down like this. Exponential decay. I suppose it would be another term for it.
These numbers are included in the report.
Yeah, all these numbers are in the report, yeah.
And
all the numbers are in the report. So I'm sorry to throw so many statistics at you, but I can do less of that.
No, it's fine.
Yeah. By the way, here's something. Okay, we're going to move on to these prolific reviewers. Here's one of the things we found. We had a way of finding out how their actual productivity compared with their own assessment of their productivity. And we found for the top 30 that 50% of them underestimate their productivity. In other words, they're writing many more reviews than they think they are. So we can actually count the number versus how many they think they're producing. We ask them, you know, are you producing so many per day, so many per week, blah, blah, blah. So they gave those estimates. And they consist, 50% of them underestimated how much they were doing. And that's because I think that, first of all, if you're producing a lot of any activity, doing a lot of any activity, it's really hard to estimate accurately if you're involved in something you do a lot of. Like if I said to you, how many glasses of water do you drink a week? You'd probably find that hard to estimate because you're probably drinking a lot. But if I said to you, how many times a week do you go to the gym? You'd probably be pretty accurate about that, okay? So we're more accurate about estimating low numbers than high numbers, things you do a lot of repeatedly. But also, I think what's going on here is that this fits in with this being this delicious hobby these people are engaged in. Anything that you find kind of really nice and fun to do and you get engaged with, you probably tend to underestimate. Just stuff, even just going online, people tend to underestimate how long they spend online. So I think this partly explains it as well. Okay. What are the techniques then? We started to read the reviews produced by these very prolific reviewers. I've read an awful lot of these reviews. So what do they review?
Better than a lot of books.
Sorry?
It's better than a lot of awful reviews.
Clorox is misspelled.
Clorox is misspelled, is
Take
it?
Take the H out.
It's to be what?
Take the H out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, thank you. So books, movies, and music are the most predominant thing reviewed at the website, okay? And books is still the biggest category. But what we found, these prolific reviewers were mixing up all sorts of stuff. And we were reading these reviews in an unusual way. We go to the reviewer, and all of their reviews are compiled together, like a portfolio. That's the way Amazon does it. You can click on a reviewer and look at all their reviews, and it goes back in time. You can go back to when they started reviewing by clicking further. And what we found is they're mixing up reviews of books with all these other things. So here's a top 10 reviewer who reviews perfumes, Belgian chocolates, tea, spices, beauty products, vacuum cleaner bags, and a bottle of Clorox. And why are they doing this? Well, I make the point here. I mean, it takes a lot of time to read a book and review it. You can do household things and chocolates a lot quicker.
Perfume, that's a weird one. I mean, one thing, perfume smells different than every person, but also, I can see where you get the chocolates, but you've got perfumes, 10 million of them, and it's bizarre.
Yeah, well, anything Amazon sells, these people can review.
Oh, and they sell them?
Yes. We're going to get on to this. Amazon has a special. Sorry?
No, do they have to get the materials that they're reviewing themselves? Or does Amazon provide it?
That's a good question. Some of them they get themselves. If it's bought from Amazon, there's a special badge you get from Amazon called Amazon Verified Purchase, which shows that you bought that particular product at Amazon, which will give more credibility, because Amazon's obviously, in fact, they've introduced this badge, they're worried about this, that where are these people getting them from? Amazon also has a scheme called Amazon Vine, introduced in 2008, where they offer freebies to their top reviewers. The top 1,000 are invited to join Amazon Vine, and they're given a choice of a whole range of products, not just advanced reading copies of books, but products as well, commercial products, like Belgian chocolates, for people, and Clorox, to choose from. And you can choose what you want to review, but if you do review it under Amazon Vine, you'll have a badge saying this is an Amazon Vine review, we put on your review. So it's showing it came from the Vine program. And Amazon also pledges that, because it's worried about, well, it'll only be positive reviews, that if there's a negative review, they won't delete the review just because it's negative of Vine products. So people get invited to join this Vine
program. Do they also review live performances? You mentioned music.
Live theatrical releases is called at the site. Yeah, they reviewed those as well. So they go to a movie and that would be a review as well.
Well, that would be a movie, but I'm talking about something live, like a stage performance or an opera.
No. Movie. There's no live. There's TV shows, and we're going to get to that in a moment. The Charlie Rose show is an interesting little thing about the Charlie Rose show in a moment. But so I just want to. Well, the point I'm trying to make here is that Amazon started off with books, and over time it's diversified its product line, and the reviewers are kind of following this. And as we'll get to see, with new ranking, Amazon is encouraging this, and with programs like Vine, it's encouraging the reviewers to diversify. But there's all sorts of really interesting questions behind this, because if you're producing a review of a serious work of literature followed by a bottle of Clorox, it raises interesting questions about how you rank this, the commensurability of the whole thing. So we'll get to this in a minute. I think it's a really interesting issue. So ways to up productivity. One way of doing it is extreme specialization. We found one of these prolific reviewers. He did 574 total reviews for the year, but 352 of them were of the Charlie Rose show. So this person had watched an awful lot of Charlie Rose. And in the report, we work out how much, if he bought the Charlie Rose from Amazon, several thousands of dollars he'd spent on Charlie Rose. So this is how you can up your productivity. You can specialize in something. This dentist, who's amongst our prolific reviewers, lots and lots of dental products, including toothpaste. So there's, he actually reviews toothpaste. So here's some more examples which we found. just a published poet reviews a toilet brush. a novelist with 38 novels reviews a pair of left-handed scissors. That was her last review when we looked at this. This professor of political science, who he likes to do baseball caps, but also he did a review of a light bulb. It was an energy-efficient light bulb. So they're mixing them up, okay? And this is, again, upping, you're diversifying from, and it's a way of upping your productivity, I think, as well. A lot of these reviews, by the way, of these sorts of products are done kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's almost as though they're aware that, hey, I've got this reputation as a literary reviewer, or I do serious political science books or books about the Civil War, and then suddenly I'm doing a light bulb.
Could they deliberately, you know, I don't mean lie, but having fun, you know, change the nature of their reviews? But by the way, what are the reviews? Are they a checklist of things, or are they written?
No, they're written. Usually, the only constraint Amazon puts on the reviews, they have to be less than 1,000 words. Typically, we found all sorts of forms. Some people do it like free consciousness. Some people do it in verse. Some people do it very tight descriptions of the products. Typically, it's in three paragraphs, the reviews. That's what most of them are like. And by the way, some of them are very well written. I don't want you to go away with the impression that these people are slouches at writing. As far as I can tell, a lot of them are surprisingly well written. And in browsing through all these reviews, Philip and I started to become fans of particular reviewers. We actually started to, you know, our wish list to Amazon grew. Say if you find someone reviewing music and they've reviewed a piece of music that you really like and they see the same thing in the music that you like, you think, well, I start to trust this person.
Has anyone gone out professionally after this and said, I've done 48 reviews for Amazon and I'm
ready for the New York Times?
And therefore is able to hire themselves out as a music critic or something?
Not as far as we know as a music critic. We have one instance of a respondent who got a job based on an Amazon review, a technical review he did as a technical writer, but no one as a professional critic yet that we know of. But it's a footstep into this world.
Is this all monetized for Amazon in any way? Is it just that it's, you know, whoopee, one more thing Amazon does?
Well, the monetization, the reviewers are not rewarded. Amazon clearly...
Amazon itself, what's Amazon getting out of it as a business?
Selling products based on these reviews. We know from other studies that and you've probably all bought products based on reviews. I certainly have.
Well, I was looking for a vacuum cleaner. It's a long story, took forever. I mean, the vacuum cleaner situation nowadays is terrible. They're all junk. There was one I was interested in, and I read the reviews on Amazon, and there were 75% pro, 25% con for the particular one, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I ended up buying it at a store on 23rd Street because I didn't trust any of them.
Well, you can read them skeptically, and I had certainly, having done this study, advised skepticism.
It was very interesting.
No, but it also been manipulative by a company that makes something and getting people to be reviewers.
Yeah. I mean, advertising's the same, of course.
Yeah, well, and that's a hidden truth. It's very difficult to discover that, you know, because you're not going into people's minds, you're going on the basis of what they've written. So,
I think the appeal, I think the persuasive appeal of this is these are ordinary people giving their immediate experiences. That's the kind of persuasive appeal.
It's sort of like ordinary people taking out your appendix. Are you sure you want that?
Well, there's a lot of errors made by physicians. Don't quote me on this. I'm not recommending anyone here takes anyone else's appendix, but... this is the idea behind this is that ordinary people have something to say. So say the reviews of my synthesizer book, a synth head is not a formal reviewer of synthesizer books, but knows an awful lot about synthesizers, can write a pretty smart review and pretty interesting review about it.
Well, this is done in dining, I know, in some of the companies that sell dining packages, you know, we get discounts, and they post all the reviews by people, and they rate different restaurants. And there it's tied in directly to their product because people are going to the restaurants where they get a discount for going. So, I mean, that's the most natural tie. This is a little, bit different than that.
Yeah, the history within Britain of the Automobile Association has done reviews of hotels, the Michelin Guide. You can look back for historical ones. The web does add something new to this, though, because people can then... look at the reviews. They're much more publicly available, and they can say if these reviews are helpful or not. This is how Amazon, this is the key thing to Amazon's ranking. You get a chance to click on that review. Was this helpful to me or not? And if you find the ranking is based not only on how many reviews you produce, but whether these reviews are found to be helpful. So the web does add something new here in this whole reviewing culture.
So they have to do something that Amazon is selling. That's the first requirement, right? They can't just review a book that they like. It has to be something that
Yes, exactly. And they often complain that books that are out of print, they can't review on Amazon because Amazon doesn't sell those books. And that's one of the common complaints. So it's got to be something that's available at the Amazon store. But Amazon increasingly takes more and more merchandise, the biggest, as we know, e-retailer in the world. So there's a lot of stuff there. shall I move on? So this is this under this underestimation. I've already gone over that point. Okay, why do they do it? So, do you want me to go back? Sorry.
No. Why?
That's okay. So, my friend Philip, when we started this research, I think he was kind of thinking that maybe some of them would express that they did it for utilitarian purposes, but there's no utilitarian reward for this other than the free stuff they get. They don't get payment. So they're mainly doing it for self-expression and enjoyment. In our survey, this is the thing that was checked the most. Self-expression and enjoyment. There's lots of other reasons, like keeping up writing skills and things like this, keeping up reading skills, serving the community as well. But self-expression and enjoyment were overwhelmingly why these...
So it's like an anonymous blog. Because a lot of people do blog, but they get their names on it. But this is an anonymous one, which is not known.
Well, they can have their name on it. Their profile can be on it as well. You can have your your profile will go to your Amazon review. It doesn't have to be anonymous.
Oh, I didn't.
So they
know
get.
That.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
they could be doing it for that reason also.
Yeah.
Be read by people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
What are the rewards?
What?
Sorry.
What are the rewards? You said free stuff.
The free stuff. We're going to get to that in a minute. I have a whole slide on that. But let me just say about it's a, I think of it as a hobby. This is how, when I read, we have a lot of, you know, what did you, one of the questions on the survey is, what did you enjoy most about reviewing for Amazon? It comes through very strongly that this, for these folks, for most of them, it's a hobby, that they have a community, and they really pride themselves on producing a corpus of what they think is useful book reviews that's going to help the rest of the community make better decisions, particularly in regards to books.
Do they buy the books, or do they call the publisher and say, I'm a reviewer, send me a review?
We're going to get to that. Some of them buy them, some of them get them from the library. We'll get to the free stuff in a minute. By the way, Amazon has its own social networking site, Amazon Friends, and 50% of them use that. So they're connected in a community, and this enables them to offer comments on each other's reviews, check out each other's reviews, and rate as helpful each other's reviews. So this is a way into the literary world as well. It is a step into the literary world, I think. A small, very small step, but it is a way for them to feel, and they get overwhelmingly expressed, they feel part of this culture of books, the book reviewers in particular. Here's an example of just somebody who gets something out of it. The ranking system. So this is the ranking system. It's a great motivator for me. I floundered intellectually after graduate school because I suddenly had no more feedback on any of my intellectual endeavors. I've often said that Amazon saved me because it gave me back my passion for writing. In all honesty, my Amazon rank has become the foundation of my self-worth. I work at a library, but I consider myself a reviewer first and foremost, and that badge tells me that I'm accomplishing something. So,
I think people are very lonely.
Yeah.
That's
pretty
sad.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a great...
Yeah.
I mean, it's really fascinating. A lot of it sounds like fun and what a way to waste time, but there's a lot of pathos in there.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, these people, they're going online, they're forming friendships with each other, supporting each other, and it's a genuine community. As a sociologist, I find that I'm not going to condemn it as and it means a lot to them, these badges. This was in response to the question, what do these ranking badges mean to you? And they do obviously care about their ranking badges. Some of them put them on their vitas, you know. One professor put it on his syllabi that he's a top 1,000 reviewer. So they get status from this. You may find it extraordinary. I'm just reporting what's out there in the world. And, you know, they put a lot of time and effort into it. It's a community that means something to them. So here's the thing about the free stuff. Our customers, they're called customer reviews, remember, really customers. And this was the thing that was a surprise to us. 85% report they've been approached by authors, agents, and publishers. And this seems to start when they enter the top 1,000, becomes more and more prolific, more and more common once they hit the top 500. And then when they hit the top 10, they're inundated. And I didn't realize that. I first discovered this with a pop science writer at Cornell told me he had a new book coming out and that he'd contacted a top Amazon reviewer to review the book. And this is apparently very commonly done. So you pick a top Amazon reviewer who does science books and send him the book. You email him, say, would you review my book? And sure, he does. And they get a lot out of the authors contacting them. And they feel, you know, this well-known author is contacting me. I'm having email exchange. And this also is important to them as well. So we found 85% report they've been approached. 78% said always or usually review the free book sent. And I said 66 belong to this Amazon vine, which is more free stuff as well. So I think the significant thing here is that a lot of people think that there's no tie between these top reviewers and the stuff that they're reviewing, but you have to realize there is. They've got a lot of them got it for free, and that was interesting. It doesn't necessarily, they all claim that this doesn't undermine their review and they're still objective. But there is a relationship, and most people do not know about it.
So you did ask them specifically, does it affect your review if you receive the free book as a result of this?
We didn't ask them that question specifically, but the questionnaires are full of them, the responses are full of them denying that it would have any effect. Okay. It's obviously something they worry about. I mean, I would worry about it if it became clear that, in fact, these books I was reviewing, I hadn't bought myself, had been sent by a publisher or by the author or an agent. It's a natural thing to worry about. So this, I think, by the way, this is the gender thing is a big discovery. No one had done that. This is a discovery as well. I think people who review these books know about it, but I think most people don't know that the top reviewers are getting all this free stuff.
Well, that's the reasons some of them may review specifically, because they're avid readers, you know, they're intellectually inclined, and they like to get the books rather than go out and buy them, and they don't mind reviewing.
Yeah, but they also report a lot of the books, the harder problem for them is turning down the endless rubbish books they're sent. They often, you get lots of statements like that, I've been sent these books to review, they're awful dogs, it's a real pain in the neck being sent all this free stuff. You get a lot of statements like that as well.
You have a percentage that indicated they have contacted, you know, publishers to get books. The percent of the reviewers that have actually gone out. Here you say they've been approached, or they usually use a free book.
We didn't ask that question because we didn't know about this. That would be a great,
that'd be a smart question. That would be a very good question.
You're right, that'd be a smart question to ask. How many of them had deliberately solicited? We didn't ask that question. Amazon Vines, that schema I mentioned earlier, started in 2008 by Amazon, which is only by invitation. You have to be in the top 1,000, it seems. The rules of this are not spelled out anyway, exactly who gets invited, where you're sent twice a month a catalogue of free stuff you can choose from to review. And you have to review a certain percentage of it for Amazon.
And that's what motivated diversity, you said.
Yeah, that motivates diversity, because Amazon's big problem has been it's moved from, a lot of these folks are still hooked on doing book reviews, but the website is moving much more. Books are a tiny part of Amazon's business, even though it started with books. They want to sell all this other stuff.
So the most of the book reviewers also will be reviewing these other things?
Yeah, most of them, we only found 8 out of our 160 who stayed with books only. 8, all of them have some of them have tried. One guy says, I did review a Swiss Army knife once, but they went back to books. So some of them have just dabbled.
Cutting edge,
yeah, exactly. Another said, I did a magazine once, but...
It's a whole underground, not exactly economy, but more than an underground culture, even. It's fascinating. And to me, it really is underground.
It's a hidden world that most of us don't know about. Yeah.
But it's related to blogging in a way, you know, because blogging started picking up a lot of people.
I don't know, for most of it seems to me it's an ego trip. Some people move it into something, useful or productive.
This is a more, Sorry to interrupt, sorry. No. This is a more self-defining culture than blogging, because these are all working for Amazon, and they're getting a ranking right. from the organization. They're ranking each other's reviews.
Question. I'm wondering if you've discovered an intrinsic difference between either the people themselves or the behavior in this particular group and all of the mainstream reviewers who review everything for, in other words, if I go and review the theater, I get a free ticket, the same with dining, the same with books. Nobody pays for anything they review. So that is the same, except I'm getting paid to review if I'm in mainstream media.
Right.
Versus these people are not getting paid. And I'm wondering if that is really the only fundamental difference that you're seeing.
So that's a good question. It's hard to get at that comparatively. Some of these folk, by the way, are, one of them at least we know is a book reviewer for a newspaper, and he cross-posts from the newspaper over to Amazon. So he's been paid by the newspaper, and he's putting the reviews on Amazon as well. But the monetary question was underlying this. Philip, my internet entrepreneur, was thinking maybe that if we could standardize the reviewing process, I think a lot of people have thought about this, and we could offer monetary rewards to people, and Amazon would, you know, eventually be forced to pay something for these reviews, and the whole thing could be standardized. And then you get this argument, well, the whole point of doing it is we don't want to be paid because then we'll be seen as corrupt. But then you have to think that professional reviewers for New York Times Book Review, of course, are being paid for it. No one says they're corrupt because they're being paid. So because you're being paid doesn't necessarily mean it's going to corrupt your values. If there's a more transparent system in place, this is the idea. So that's a good question. So it'd be interesting to compare. I, having done this, I thought it'd be nice to do a study, especially after the, I think it's Ruth Franklin study, showing the gender. It'd be nice to do a study, actually, of book reviewers in general. I mean, I'm a book reviewer, an academic one, but, you know, the ones who write the London Review of Books and so on, New York Review. Okay, just some other problems, just in the ranking. I'm coming to the end here. Our reviewers report, the trolls is the word they use for people who mark their reviews as being unhelpful. So what's been happening is people systematically, so if you find another reviewer who you may worry about is going to take your place in the ranking, you may go to their review and say, that review was unhelpful, and go back and mark all their reviews as being unhelpful. That would be an attack by a troll. But it could be all sorts of things that set it off. We found interesting things in the comments that they send us on this. For instance, there was a guy did a negative review of Colin Firth's performance as Darcy in Pride and Prejudice, the BBC production. And all the Colin Firth fans got outraged by this and immediately marked this review as being unhelpful. So political things can set it off as well. If you deal with political, religious topics, this is going to put you into the territory of troll attacks. And this has been a problem at the website, that these unhelpful. It's not clear. Amazon has introduced new ranking as a way of getting rid of people who are systematically gaming the system by marking reviews as being helpful, but it's not clear they've been able to deal with the unhelpful aspect. And this is still going on, it seems. So October 2008, Amazon introduced the new ranking to discourage gaming. And one of the things it did was it looked at when people systematically voted things as being helpful. It called those fans and disallowed their votes. And this caused outrage to some people because for many of our reviewers, they thought that their fans were just legitimate people that follow their reviews and like their reviews. So of course they're going to check them as being helpful. But now Amazon is saying these are fans and their positive votes that this is helpful is disallowed. The new ranking system also put more weight on more recent reviews. So it's encouraging. So if you've done a whole weight of reviews over 13 years, it's putting more weight on the newer stuff you're doing. And so this encourages people. You get a higher ranking the more you produce now, rather than rely on the stuff you've done in the past. Okay, that's the main difference. And all these are secret, by the way. The formula Amazon uses is secret. It's not transparent, as it's very common on the internet, as we know for virtually all these ranking systems. So this is just what we guess is going on from the forums, the chat, and watching what's happening.
Could we say that this industry or whatever of customer reviewers is something created by Amazon, or that Amazon once realized how important are the customer reviewers and decided to start introducing these new rankings and...
Exactly. I think that's a great question. They stumbled into it, as far as we can see. They stumbled into it, and then they suddenly realized,
they realized how important this could be, how it would improve their sales.
Yeah, this would start to improve their sales, and these people really wanted to do this. They didn't need these literary editors anymore. They could then start to rank these reviews. Wouldn't that be great to rank them? That's one of the things they can do with this helpful, unhelpful thing. They started putting the most helpful reviews on the top left-hand side. So when you go to Amazon, you see the most helpful reviews are there immediately.
When did start this? When did they realize? I know it's hard to...
It's hard to get an exact date on it. As far as we have reviewers who have been reviewing for 13 years. So from 2008, go back 13 years, which is, somebody do the math, help me here, 95. So it's around 95 that we think. These books by Spector on the history of the company and Marcus don't actually say, they say who invented the term. They don't say when exact year. You could probably go back with web shots to find exactly, of the Amazon site to find exactly the year ranking. My guess is 95. And they're tinkering with it all the time. So this thing that they did, this was a major change, introducing a whole new ranking system. That was a major change. But they're tinkering with this all the time.
Has there ever been any way to correlate helpful rankings with sales? I mean, what is done for sales on Amazon? In other words, books very favorably reviewed, consistently reviewed. I don't know how you correlate. I'm just wondering. Is that a question that you looked at or looking at figures of what has happened with top rankings?
It hasn't been done with the top rankings, but there's an article we cite in our study. There's two articles in our study that show that product reviews sell products. Economic sociologists have shown that, but they haven't yet correlated with the top 1,000, because we're the first people to actually study these top 1,000. So, but just in general, product reviews do sell products. That's well known.
Is helpful more correlated with positive or with negative reviews?
Helpful is positive. So, if this review is helpful, is positive. Yeah, when
so
you
a
do a review,
a negative review is not helpful. If it says don't buy this product, it's terrible.
I misunderstood what you said. You mean whether the review was positive or negative? The actual reviews on Amazon. This is another finding that's well known. Follow this binary structure. Most of the reviews are overwhelmingly positive, and there's a few negative ones. The stars, you have either 1 star or 5 stars. The ones in between are very rarely used. This, again, there's sites in the literature. This has been shown for huge samples. 88% of our respondents said they gave overwhelmingly positive reviews.
So if someone reads a review of something other, and it's a negative, and they don't buy it, that's helpful, but... Does Amazon think it's helpful?
Amazon, Jeff Bezos has said, we want the truth out there, so we want negative reviews as well. So Amazon isn't going to delete negative reviews. It just so happens, this is the way the economy works, that you realize that if you do a negative review, you're going to attract the trolls, and people are going to say this was unhelpful, because it's much easier to do a positive review. That's the way it works. So if you do a negative review, and... you're more likely to come out under troll attack and people saying this review was very unhelpful.
So that completely undermines Consumer Reports, which tells you things are terrible all the time.
Yes, it's an interesting thing to think about Consumer Reports versus this. I think Consumer Reports will have much more critical takes on products than this does. Absolutely.
All of the reviews that are posted on Amazon, what percentage of them come from these top 1,000 people versus people like me? You know, just random people? In other words, let's say on a given day there's 10,000 reviews.
How many are just
from transient folk, and how many are from these super...
It's hard to... I mean, we could do that, but it's we'd have to get the... if you're talking about the top... You could probably do it for the top 10 very easily. If you knew the total number of reviews on Amazon, I don't know if we know the total number of reviews on Amazon.
Like when I'm reading reviews, if I'm looking at a new book and I'm reading reviews and there's 20 reviews, how many of these are these hardcore reviewers and how many of people who just felt very compelled to talk about something that struck them, either positively or negatively. In other words, how many of them are authentically reviewing because of a passionate reaction versus, I review, that's what I do, is I review.
Yeah, it's hard to measure that. I think that's a great question. And most of these reviewers start off. See, it's interesting, their motivation changes over time. Most of them start off because they have something to say about the book. Then they get this ranking, and it's a hobby, but they have to keep their ranking up. And they all report this. It's like, that's a drag. You have to keep your ranking up, but you don't want to lose your ranking because it means something to them. So then it's...
Yeah, I'm sorry. So anyone could become a reviewer, though, right?
Anyone in there, anybody could. We all could.
I'm sure I've done it.
Well, you've got a ranking. You can check it. Go to community. Go to your. You'll have a.
No,
you'll have a rank. Everyone has a ranking, so you'll be in the millions probably. I am. I've done a few, and I'm in the millions.
I just wanted to point out the time in case there's anybody who has to stick to their time frame. We're running a little over.
Sorry, we're nearly done. Let me just quickly.
Stay, please, by all means.
You've all asked me so many interesting questions that we got a little. But it's great. Okay, how do we think about this? You'll see on AMI. AMI is the term that the reviewers use for Amazon, AMI. And we call her Aunt AMI in our study. And we think, what's going on with this new ranking? You can read a little section of it where we talk about that there's a nephew called, it's like she has this new nephew called New Ranking. She keeps her elder nephew, Classic Ranking, hanging on. It's like they all work for this, we think of it as like this distant great aunt that they're working away for. She pats them on the back. She's getting very, very wealthy based on their labors. Suddenly a new kid on the block, new ranking comes along. But she doesn't want to get rid of old ranking. She keeps them hanging on. It's there. This is how we think of it. You'll see this little section of the report. So what have we got today? We have these two ranking systems, which is pretty weird to have. You know, if you think of like the pop charts, you're either number one or you're number six or something. But here you can be number one and number, you know, literally number a million. One guy went down a million under new ranking. So he went from the top 1,000, this is top 1,000 in one and a million in the other. So you can have, you know, it's pretty weird to have two ranking systems running together. And then you have this problem of the way Amazon works is it has commensuration. So the ranking systems, both ranking systems, are based upon whatever you review, post-its, literary fiction, cookbooks, whatever, that they're all part of the same ranking system. If people find it helpful, then you're in the ranking system. They don't make any differentiation. And you could imagine it could be set up so that Amazon has these different product categories, that you had a ranking system for each product category. So you were number one in household goods, say, number one in books, number one in music, or whatever, or number 20 in music. But the way it works, it's just one ranking system. So Amazon's assuming that the process of writing these reviews is a process of commensuration, of things being comparable. And this is their conceit. This is the amazing thing about Amazon. All products can be sold the same way. This is the great ease of the website, by one-click ordering. Amazon's conceit is that buying a product and using a product are the same thing. So I think of a book review as being my experience of using the book. You can't judge a book from the cover. And it's true of all these products. It's about the use of the product. That's what the customer is reporting on. But Amazon is incorporating that customer report into the selling process. So they've made it part of the buying process as well, selling and buying. But I think they're very different things. And that's its conceit. That's what it's doing. But it's running into all these problems as a result of that. So we have these two ranking systems. You have the kind of absurdity, as I say, of a poet suddenly reviewing a toilet brush, which does seem on the face of it rather absurd. I'm not saying...
Why not?
You could have a community of expertise on toilet brushes. I'm not saying that. So I think you can have people, you know, post-its. You can have people who are really into post-its. It's probably not quite the same as a literary work, but you can imagine a community of people who are looking at different sorts of ways they stick and so on. There's all sorts of subtleties in it. And so I'm not saying that you couldn't have a community of skill based on that and a differentiation, but Amazon's conceit is it puts them all together in one bucket. All these products are all ranked the same way in terms of the reviewers. So here's Aunt Amy the free. Aunt Amy likes the reviewers, gives them status, a hobby, and a step into the literary world. She gets the free lunch. You know, that she can sell products based on these. But many reviewers don't like the changes in the ranking systems. As Aunt Amy gets wealthier and review systems suffer crisis of credibility, will the reviewers want a part of the cake? This is the question I'm so left with. I think that the system is having some problems of credibility. Something we picked up in our survey, that reviewers don't like the fact that the ranking system has changed, and these problems I've pointed to. The
so
issues
is there ultimately an endless supply of reviewers? I mean,
oh yeah,
more people come, more people get older, more people do this, more people do that. So if the previous ones drop off, they're more coming up.
Yeah, and you can say Amazon's smart because that's why new ranking's all about, encouraging newer reviewers to enter, review a greater diversity of products. They're the new kid on the block, as it were.
So it becomes a source of pride for some of the reviewers to say, I am a reviewer, right? Did you discover that?
Yes, oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. As I said, they put it on their CV, some of them. Yeah.
Now, there's a level of absurdity in... There's a level of absurdity in ranking Post-it notes at the same time that you're ranking cookbooks and giving similar credibility to the reviewer of each. On the other hand, for the purchaser, for the customer, who really is the focus of Amazon ultimately, right?
Yeah.
The customer wants to know that this... Maybe it's a post-it note. Maybe the 3M post-it note has better adhesive than the no-name post-it note, and the customer actually does want to know that. So it's absurd on one level, but on the other hand, it's essential. Right?
Yeah. It's essential. I'm not saying it's absurd at one level, but I'm not saying I would agree it's essential. You could imagine a better system might be that you had ranking of post-it notes people. So you had a separate subcategory. So you say, I'm the number one ranked person on Post-it notes. That would seem to me to be a slightly better system, or at least differentiate office products. Right. So that's the claim here.
I see. That's your claim.
That's our claim.
Right.
I don't know why Amazon doesn't do this. Why doesn't Amazon get rid of plagiarism? If we can find plagiarism on the Amazon site, and we don't have the resources of Amazon, they could find this plagiarism and get rid of it if they want. So
They
don't care, so they're probably not caring about this.
They're doing very well, and they don't care.
Really. Yeah.
They care about plagiarism.
And credibility is not really part of this, because you don't know the reviewers personally. You don't know what their background is.
Or if they are getting the product from
their relation to it, so it's...
When it says that if they want the part of the cake, the answer would be at this point that they are not interested because they don't want to be seen as corrupted or...
Yeah, that's their worry. But some of them have expressed to us, there's a small number who said if you could get a working system where we were rewarded properly for this work, they would be interested in it.
They would be.
They would be, yeah.
To get paid.
To get paid, yeah. Yeah, or some economic recompense.
Do you know what's the percentage of how many of them...
I could email it to you if you asked me. We'd have to get. It's not actually in the report, that percentage.
What does that last bullet point mean? As Aunt Amy gets wealthier and the review system suffers a crisis, what does Amazon getting wealthier have to do with the credibility?
Amazon's getting wealthier based upon these product reviews,
right?
And then we pointed to these problems with the reviewing system. Two systems. The reviewer's getting free stuff, which somewhat undermines a little bit of the credibility of the reviewing system, the plagiarism and so on, the copying of text. So we're posing it as a question. Will reviewers, will they want part of the Aunt Amy's wealth?
Sharing it in terms of free goods, I'd say yes.
Yeah, free goods or some sort of, you can imagine a system set up where you were paid for the reviews.
Right.
But that, of course, might damage. We end up reporting, but of course, that might damage because these people are, most of them, the book reviewers are brought up with literary values where they see that utilitarian values clash with those. And so that would mean they were somehow being corrupted. But then we point to, in fact, in the world of New York Times book reviewers, everyone knows they're paid for them. You don't have to, being paid doesn't necessarily mean being corrupt. It's just what you're worth. In other words, there could be there could be a market value for these reviews.
Well, there's sometimes more credibility because if someone is paid, the assumption is that person's opinion is worth the payment.
Yeah.
So there's a certain kind of status.
He's been vetted.
Yeah. So you can imagine the top reviewer's been paid more. Exactly. You can imagine a staggered system like that.
If you were to go that way, though, wouldn't you also have the employee rating system?
Yes, you'd have to.
You can't pay people to plagiarize. You can't pay people to just
No, you'd have to have, this is the idea, would be to try and set up a system which would standardize things and get rid of the plagiarism. Getting rid of the plagiarism, I think, is relatively trivial. If my colleagues at Cornell, we can find it, then you can get rid of it. I mean, we're not paid an awful lot. So problem could be solved. But yeah, it would have to be some way of standardizing it, and then you wouldn't, it'd be like any work, you know, if you were cheated, you wouldn't be paid.
So the answer, so will reviewers want a part of the cake is not a...
It's
a rhetorical question.
It's a rhetorical question, yeah.
I guess I misunderstood that you're saying they probably would not want to, but they may want to.
Some of them, as I said, a small percentage want to at the moment. I think more of them will want to over time, is my prediction.
Are there any other sites that do something like this? Review? Like Amazon, that there are other sites that sell things, that offer things.
Oh, lots of them, yeah.
I mean, anything to this degree is sophisticated.
No, Amazon seems to have the most sophisticated of these product review systems, yeah. That's why we... But I mean, other. I mentioned earlier.
No, I know. There are other. I just meant that this kind of revering this degree of sophistication.
No, this Amazon is the most sophisticated. It's the first one. It's the most interesting site because it introduced product review for the first time, and it's clearly. It's the biggest e-retailer on the planet.
I think it'd be interesting for you to. It's just my thought as a customer of Amazon and another site that they recently bought, which is Zappos.
Right.
I think it'd be interesting to have you compare Amazon to Zappos.
Great
idea. Which they now own.
Right.
But which have two very different cultures.
Yeah, I don't know very much about Zappos, so tell me a little bit.
It's a very different site.
Yeah.
It's very, I frankly much prefer it to Amazon.
What would you say the chief difference was?
Chief difference is cultural at the companies, is in the way, and cultural from my perspective as a customer in their attitude toward customers and customer service. Zappos will do free shipping both ways, and you have 365 days, 1 year to return something.
Oh, great.
And if you get VIP status, they do free overnight shipping to you when you purchase them.
Does Zappos have its own ranking system as well?
And they just started some sort of badge system, which they haven't, they've sort of partly implemented it. So I, as a user, am getting these points and getting these badges just, it's seemingly for searching for products and viewing products. But they haven't implemented what those badges mean or signify, so they've yet to introduce that. I think it'd be interesting.
So you have other studies in the works, right?
Yeah, you've given me some, yeah.
How about after these things that you have discovered with this study, Amazon will like them or not? So, is Amazon going to be worried of what you discover in the?
Well, it wasn't worried by a plagiarism study. It must have known about it, probably. I think it's probably not going to. I don't think they're going to be quaking in their beds over it.
I don't even think they're going to be affected at all.
But yeah, it's a great. I think it's a good question. What would their attitude? I think
something that it's not as clear as it is. I mean, not everybody knows that customer reviews is a business. This is a business.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think your question is absolutely legitimate and good.
People start realizing that, hey, what you are reading in those customer reviews, maybe it's not exactly what you think it is.
Yeah, I think this could be damaging because of the free products that most people don't know about.
I don't know if Zappos does
that.
You don't think they'll care that much?
I don't think they'll care that much. I don't think the information will filter down below the level of people who are really interested in learning and this sort of thing. So I don't think it'll filter around enough to make any difference to Amazon.
Yeah, when I've talked to ordinary people about this, they're surprised to hear.
I think Amazon would say so
much. Have you approached Amazon?
No, we've done this completely independent of Amazon. Some of my colleagues work with, have relationships with Amazon. I'm more worried that I'm going to damage their relationships doing this study, but I'm completely independent.
Isn't the idea from my perspective as someone going to Amazon as an ordinary shopper that if there's a larger number of reviews, therefore a larger diversity of opinions, and they all seem to be leaning one way, that might be more valid than, say, three reviewers, three of them positive and two negative, versus 578 reviewers who are the same percentage positive?
Doesn't the volume that, or the number of reviews make a difference in terms of credibility?
I think we need to do studies of that, how people read the reviews and what sort of credibility, what sort of numbers they look for.
Yeah, that's how I look.
Because if it's all positive, you might start to be suspicious.
Right.
And how the reviews are written, that seems to be, there's a whole interesting part here of the story in terms of the rhetoric of these reviews. How they're written, do you include your own personal experience in writing, in reading the book or, you know, using the printer or whatever,
right,
seems to be a key part of it. That, yeah. So the credibility that the user establishes, how genuine they are, and the problem, are they empathetic to other ordinary users, seems to be a key thing. So we need to do studies of exactly that.
Okay.
It seems we could learn some interesting things from that.
That's how I approach reviews of restaurants on Yelp, also, as an example.
Right. Yeah, I think people have develop their own rubrics and their own sort of kind of skepticism. It'd be interesting to compare different people's, yeah, you know, interview people. So how do you read these and judge them? And is there a common rubric? And then if we knew what the common rubric was, because the trouble is with all these, then people would game it because they'd go to the common rubric and try and tailor their reviews to meet the common rubric. So that's always the problem here.
It's probably prevalent on dating sites, too.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into dating.
We'll be following this up
with other... Well, we've established... what we've done so far is we established all this at this web... where's my last slide? I think it's got the website. Has it got... Oh, yeah, there it is. Free lunch. We put this up at the website. We put some forums up for... So all our respondents will have a chance to reply. Amazon can reply. Anybody can reply who's got an interest in this topic. And at the moment, we're not engaged in any other studies, but... we've got lots of ideas here for more study.
An awful lot.
There's one I wish you would do. If you ever pull yourself out of this, which could last a lifetime, I think it's TripAdvisor, the one that does the hotel reviews, which I watch, I read this, and because I work in travel, and it's absolutely fascinating. And the violent controversies between, this is the most marvelous hotel I've ever been in. Oh my God, it was infested with bed bugs. I mean, there's lots of question about how really true a lot of these things are and how many
absolutely
of these are cooked.
Yeah.
It's even trickier, I think, than Amazon.
There's a little study of, I think it's TripAdvisor, that Wanda Olakoski at MIT and Sue Scott at the LSE are doing. I think they're doing TripAdvisor. It's either Travelocity or TripAdvisor, one of those travel sites. And you're right, it's rife with stuff that are fake, almost certainly fake reviews, that really can be devastating to a hotel if someone puts it, never stayed there, and writes a negative
the
review.
For a product or a book. I mean, if you give a bad review of something, it could have an impact on how it gets sales or not.
Absolutely, yeah. Like a positive one can increase, a negative one can really be devastating as well.
Well, what we're becoming now is a nation of contributors, you know, which didn't exist before the advent of the web to any large degree.
Yeah.
But so many people, even if they're checking the reviews and looking, they are contributing something, and people didn't do this before.
Right.
So there's a giant feeling of people being swept up into something, and this isn't just here, it's all over the world. Mm.
Yeah, that's the positive, right.
I'm interested to go for you, and I think it's interesting, you may not. I recently, in the context of travel, I recently stayed at a hotel in the Metro DC area, which was reviewed on either TripAdvisor or Yelp. And a number of the reviewers mentioned one of the ladies who worked behind the counter by name and said, she's great, she's one of the greatest receptionist hotel desk clerks we've ever encountered, she was so helpful, dot, dot, dot. And when I went to the hotel, she was actually there, which I thought was interesting. She was a real person.
Mm. And
I don't think that's the case. And I mentioned this. I said, oh, you're the famous so-and-so. Mm. And her colleague looked at me and said, yeah, she's the one they all mention, which I thought was interesting. It was this other colleague who was there. So I think it's interesting, the impact. I don't know if you study this or not, but and it's a little more remote with an author, but maybe the impact on the thing, or in this case, the person being reviewed. I just think maybe there's more of a sociology study in that.
Yeah, well, my comment about the novelist beginning, he was the impact on him of somebody writing a negative review on his novel was kind of pretty devastating. Same for these hotels, suddenly they face
this
negative.
Was just an individual working at a hotel who was yeah.
his name. Suppose they had named someone yeah. a yeah. desk clerk.
They build a career out of being the person mentioned.
You can't be fired.
Can I just respond? There's about this general issue on the internet. I mean, drawing in the wisdom, but there's other things going on that are kind of negative as well. If you think of this helpful or not, there's this binary reduction going on as well. These voting systems that are kept secret and these ranking systems that are all secret. And that, I mean, so your opinion of the review might be, yeah, bits of it were okay. You might have quite a subtle view of it, but it's reduced to yes or no, helpful or not. And that is what the web does very well in these voting systems, but that's a disadvantage, I think.
I'm concerned about the vote. I happen to be involved in something right now personally, is that professional firms can come out and gather votes, you know, mm-hmm. if they're needed for something. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be a web-based company now that's going to go into that business. Mm. I guarantee you that, you know, because there are so many things now and so many different things where he has to vote, to choose in different ways, and it becomes patently unfair. I'd rather see jury things, you know, rather than mass voting and popularity contests. I mean, the things like, for example, I'll take a very mundane thing, the All-Star Baseball game. Certainly, if a team wanted to elevate one of its players, you know, could set up a system and gather thousands and thousands of votes. The whole thing is basically corrupt the system right now. And that's my fear, that it's just getting out of hand now.
Right.
Which is why it might be so interesting to do a study of the shoppers themselves. So do people like us who go on to Amazon just see it as another who's the most popular girl in high school vote?
Right.
Or do they actually attach credibility to these reviews?
Yeah. I never even noticed the person. I just read the reviews.
You're reading a review of probably maybe a press agent wrote it. I mean, so what are you attaching as far as significance to
it?
Invisible review.
Are you reading the reviews after all of these? Are you?
Yeah. I'm still reading them. Yeah, and I've still got that big wish list, and it keeps extending. I'm following.
What about the reviews for your book?
Am I reading them? Well, if anyone posts a new one, yeah, I'll go and look at it. Yeah.
I mean, how is it doing?
How's my book doing?
On Amazon.
This book came out in 2002, but it's doing rather well. It's still selling consistently, but that's because
selling is really good. But what about Amazon? I mean, that's prestige.
You mean the reviews? How are the reviews?
It's got 17.5. It's doing very well in how useful and helpful and positive reviews. It was a great book, yeah.
We've run over quite significantly, so I do want to recognize it, but I did ask a personal question that might also be beneficial to anybody else. What is the extension ME? I am not familiar with it. Maine?
It's
Maine.
No. It's Montenegro.
Montenegro.
That's where my collaborator, Philip, comes from. And it's kind of a cool one, .me. He bought it for $15.
To go to the site and contribute your own thoughts, and thank you so much. This is, as no doubt, I'm sure everybody still has many other questions.
Well, thank you very much for coming.
It's been absolutely
I've learned a lot and gotten some new ideas as well.